These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled A Brief History of the World, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Peter N. Stearns. Professor Stearns is Provost and Professor of History at George Mason University. He received his bachelor's degree summa cum laude, his master's degree, and his doctorate in history from Harvard University. Professor Stearns was trained in European social history and has written books and articles on emotions, child rearing, dieting and obesity, old age, and work as they concern people in both Europe and the United States. He has also written widely and influentially in the field of world history, including authoring two textbooks that have gone through multiple editions. He has also written thematic books on world history, including The Industrial Revolution in World History, Gender in World History, Consumerism in World History, Western Civilization in World History, and Childhood in World History. He edited the sixth edition of the Encyclopedia of World History and is currently editing the Encyclopedia of Modern World History. His recent books, Global Outrage: The Evolution and Impact of World Opinion, and American Fear, illustrate his interest in using history to understand contemporary patterns of behavior. At George Mason University, Professor Stearns annually teaches a world history course for undergraduates. He previously taught at the University of Chicago, Rutgers, and Carnegie Mellon. While at Carnegie Mellon, he won the Smith Award for Teaching and Educational Service in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, as well as the Spencer Award for Distinguished Teaching. Professor Stearns has also worked extensively for the Advanced Placement Program, and from 1996 to 2006, he chaired the committee that devised and implemented the Advanced Placement World History course. He has also served as Vice President of the American Historical Association, heading its teaching division from 1995 to 1998. Dr. Stearns also founded and still edits the Journal of Social History. Professor Stearns prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, a timeline, a glossary, biographical notes, and an annotated bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. What and why is world history?
The rise of world history has been one of the most important developments in American history education and, to some extent, scholarship over the past two decades. So we'll begin with a bit of cheerleading. Most high school students now take some version of a world history course in the United States. An advanced placement program has grown immensely rapidly over the past 5 years. Colleges, widely, though not uniformly, have introduced world history sequences. And the development of best-selling history books like Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel reminds us that the general public is also interested in world history approaches. So this is a course about world history, and what I want to do in this first session is define the beast, talk about why it's developed so rapidly, talk about some problems that are undeniable in the field, and then turn finally to a few remaining definitional issues. One of the obvious challenges of world history is the extent to which it can include everything, and indeed it is fascinating that one can add so many different experiences and places and time periods to one's sense of how the world has developed. But any world history, whether it's a semester course or a 2-year sequence, or a big textbook. Any world history is selective, and indeed that's one of the first things that is enjoined upon us as world historians. It's also not random selection. The key point in world history is that there are three major approaches, usually applied in combination to some extent, that help us decide what we're going to focus on. The first approach, it's probably the easiest, also probably the least rewarding in the long run, but the first approach involves studying major civilizations, several of them from the word go, and talking about how they developed and how they helped define the experience of at least many, usually most, of the people in societies around the world. But this civilizational approach risks being random if it's not combined with an active interest in comparison. So the first approach in world history involves looking at major civilizations, but also bringing them together in comparison so we can see what they share, which is a crucial aspect of the dynamic of world history, how they differ, which is also obviously important, and through comparison, avoid the sense of it's Thursday, it must be China. Okay, that's approach number one. Approach number two, which is probably what world historians get most enthusiastic about, involves attention to cases where major societies, including civilizations, come into contact with each other. And we look at how this contact occurs, how it changes both parties to the contact, and use this as a framework for talking about broader changes in the experience of peoples around the world. The third approach relates to contacts, but emphasizes the emergence of broader forces, forces that will help define contacts, help define the experiences of individual civilizations, forces like new trade patterns, new migration patterns, new disease patterns, new missionary efforts. Okay? So you've got a combination of three emphases: civilizational approaches and comparisons, contacts, and these broader cross-cutting forces. And these are the components that we use to help us select what materials to emphasize, and frankly also what in the vast array of knowledge about the world's past, what we can leave out. The approaches obviously are normally used in some combination. For example, when you talk about contact, you need some sense of what the individual civilizations involved in the contact consist of. So civilization and contact, to some extent, often go together. When you talk about the impact of new trade patterns, you need to interpret this impact through the experience of individual civilizations. So broad forces, yes, but leavened by the attention to individual cases. The three approaches, and particularly the last two, the contact and the broader forces, also help us define key time periods in world history. A second way, besides selecting major emphases, a second way that world historians make their subject matter manageable and, I think, meaningful, involves the decision to emphasize a rough coherence in certain key periods of time, and these periods in turn are defined particularly by changes in patterns of contact and or changes in some of the cross-cutting forces, such as the diffusion of new technologies, the emergence of new trade patterns, etc. Civilizational developments may fit this pattern as well, but they're less crucial in defining the major time periods. In this world history course, as in frankly most, there's wide agreement here. In this world history course, we'll be emphasizing a number of key time periods, such as the classical period, which is roughly familiar to many users of history, running from about 1000 BCE to about 500 CE. We'll then turn to the post-classical period, and this will require some definition later on. It's a bland term deliberately. After that, we turn to the early modern period, which runs from roughly 1450 CE to about 1750 or 1800. We then turn to the long 19th century, which again we will define more clearly later on. And finally, the contemporary period, which in some ways, predictably enough, since we're still in it, is the most challenging of all. The rise of world history, and I started out emphasizing how rapid and important this has been, the rise of world history owes its nature to a number of key causes. But it's been an unusual rise in two or three respects. First of all, world history has emerged initially more as a teaching field than as a research field, though, as we'll see, research is beginning to catch up. That's not the way new fields usually develop in American or anybody else's higher education. Second, and this is probably related, world history did not emerge initially, for the most part, at the United States' most prestigious universities. And indeed, the Ivy League was slow to make the turn to world history, and only really in the past 5 years has begun adding serious world history components. Finally, and this will come up a little bit in our discussion later on as well, the field is not evenly developed across the world, which is somewhat ironic since we're talking about a global approach. World history, I think it's fair to say, is particularly well developed in the United States. There's interesting work in China and Japan. A few European countries have developed significant world history programs, the Netherlands, for example. And there's growing interest in Germany, Italy, and elsewhere, but it's still pretty much a first step. And whole societies like the United Kingdom, although they contribute significant scholarship to world history, have yet to introduce world history significantly in their educational programs at all. So there are some oddities to the development of the field, and this may help explain why there continues to be significant debate about it. The reasons world history has developed so strongly, the reasons why I think it's a valid entrant into what people should know about the past, are really threefold, and they're not particularly complicated. First, this was more crucial probably 20 years ago than it is now because the development of world history itself has tended to respond to this factor. But the first factor involves the changes in the composition of the American student body. As more and more students in American universities can legitimately claim that their heritage attaches to some part of the world other than the West and Western Europe, they understandably pressed at institutions like Stanford and Columbia, they understandably pressed for a history course that would respond to some of their identity issues, some of their concerns, along with the more conventional appeal to Western origins. So that's factor number one. Factor number two, and this is the biggie, very simple, is the extent to which, since the 1950s, the United States has become engaged with a whole world and not simply with a Western world. This engagement logically propels us to look for a kind of historical perspective that will give us some basis, some context for understanding the world at large rather than one important but narrower slice of it. And finally, cause number three, the rise of world history. I won't claim this at the origins, but the rise of world history by now is also including significant advances in scholarship that make it clear that you can use the world history's perspective to gain better understanding of key passages in the past, and you can embellish that perspective precisely by learning more. And we'll talk a little later about where these gains in scholarship have been particularly noteworthy, but it's an ongoing process. Okay. This said, we've defined the animal, we've argued at least briefly that it's a manageable product, not simple, but manageable, and we've talked about why it's gained ground. The next thing to note is that there are three kinds of objections to world history that truth in advertising we also need to talk about, because you need to consider these as you go through the process of greater exposure to world history itself. The most telling conflict, and it is a conflict, sometimes referred to as part of the culture wars, the most telling conflict is the conflict between doing world history and doing Western civilization. In 1994, a group of historians, well-intentioned, careful, produced a set of national history standards for world history. The goal was to help high schools decide what they should be emphasizing, what their students should know on the emergence from a secondary school history program. This set of national standards was condemned 99-1 by the United States Senate in 1994. Now, 1994 was the year in which conservative legislators took power in the United States Congress. In my opinion, there was a fair amount of political posturing and grandstanding in this vote, but it's a very dramatic vote. And the vote was predicated on the extent to which emphasis on world history standards, as some of the senators stated, detracts from the special valuation Americans should give to Western traditions. There is, as you all know, a longstanding, respectable, and indeed very important tradition of teaching Western civilization in American colleges and universities. The tradition began in the teens and 20s of the 20th century. It was spearheaded by leading figures like James Harvey Robinson, an historian at Columbia. And the argument was, in essence, twofold. One, that it was possible to trace a line of historical development from ancient Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt on to Greece and then Rome, then on to Western Europe, and then some would argue, ultimately, on to the American hemisphere, and particularly the North American hemisphere. I had a student once who told me that his high school instructor said that there was indeed a law of history that argued that civilization would steadily spread westward, and I had images of civilization seeping beyond the coast of California and running aground at the international dateline. Frankly, it's a silly approach from a world historian standpoint, but it reflects the tremendous emphasis Americans have long given to Western civilization. The second part of the Western civilization argument, and again, it's perfectly respectable, deserves serious attention, is that the United States is, broadly speaking, part of a Western tradition, and therefore that students need to pay particular attention to the emergence of Western institutions and values. These are good arguments, and they continue to create a debate, not always a clash, but they continue to create a debate, given finite amounts of time, a debate about whether one should plump for a Western civ approach or a world approach. The world historians argue several things, although the arguments vary a little bit depending on the individual. Some world historians, frankly, and there's no reason not to admit this, really think that one of the purposes of a world history course is to bash the West. This is not my approach. I don't think it's fruitful or necessary. The West has certainly contributed many good things to the global experience. Also, frankly, some bad things. This can be noted either within a Western Civ context or a world context. The bashing approach is not part of my own personal lexicon. But, more validly, world historians make, I think, a couple of other claims. The key one, of course, and this is just part of the debate, the key one is that at this point in time, it's more important for American students to learn something about the world as a whole, including the West, including how the West fits into larger world patterns, than it is to learn about the Western tradition more narrowly. World historians, particularly those of us who were not particularly interested in West bashing, not uncritical, but not bashing, world historians would also argue that you don't lose the opportunity in world history to get some sense of how the West developed, what some of its distinctive features were, both good and bad, so you don't lose all of the value of what many people have treasured in a Western civ approach. But this is a debate. It is important to note that the choice of world history in a teaching program, unless you can have time for both world history and the West, the choice of world history does involve a really different set of emphases from the Western Civ tradition. And world historians get particularly, and I think legitimately, concerned about compromise efforts that will claim that this course is a world history course, but really turn out to be the Western experience with one or two chapters on other societies. This is what we in the trade call the West and the Rest approach. And we think it distorts the way the world developed, and we think it's actually misleading, and we hope that increasingly, and I believe this is in fact the case, it will go away. World history argues that Western civilization is one of a number of major civilizations. It's not always the most important one, though its importance would certainly grow in more modern times, and it needs to be viewed in a more global context. It needs to be viewed comparatively. It needs to be viewed as part of a larger package. A second concern about world history, and this is probably a little bit more technical within the discipline of history itself, a second concern is perfectly understandable, deserves real attention, and that is that even aside from the special claims of the West, world history simply can't adequately convey the complexities of individual traditions. This argument comes particularly from historians dealing with East Asian civilizations, and it's very simple. It's not totally different from some of the Western civ concerns, though it doesn't have the identity factors attached. The concern here is that Chinese history, say, is so nuanced, so complex, that if you try to put a Chinese slice in world history, you inevitably simplify, you inevitably elide some of the crucial passages. And this is a perfectly respectable opinion. It is obviously true that in world history, one will not be giving the degree of detailed attention to China or to the West that a more specific civilizational approach will offer. I think the gains outweigh these liabilities, but liabilities undeniably exist. The third objection is actually interesting, and I will mention it. I don't quite know what to make of it. It's come up more recently as some Europeans have attempted to insert themselves into a world history framework. And this criticism argues that world history is somehow, or at least world history as developed by Americans, is somehow yet another product of American imperialism. Now, this comes at a time where, of course, there are a lot of criticisms of American foreign policy, and to some extent, I think these criticisms simply jump on that bandwagon. As I try to parse out the criticisms, I think that they reflect, a European anxiety about the American lead in this field, understandable but not necessarily creditable, and a sort of backhanded concern that American world historians have indeed ended up leaving too much of the European experience out, which sort of goes back to the Western Civ objections, but from a slightly different route. I mentioned this. I don't think it's a terribly serious objection because, in my judgment, world historians in the United States have made tremendous effort to avoid an imperialist taint, to deal reasonably and even-handedly with the experiences of various societies, including those that came under Western control at certain points. I don't think this one sticks, but it certainly should be noted. Okay. The definition of world history in terms of some combination of three major approaches, the sense of why world history has become important, the recognition that there continue to be objections, which I think can be answered, but certainly need to be noted and remembered as we actually go through a world history system. These issues need, finally, to be refined in terms of a few other essentially definitional features within the broader framework. First is the question of timing. There are three kinds of emphases in terms of chronology in world history, beyond the specific periods that I mentioned earlier, that we need to pay attention to as we run through the system itself. First is emphasis on early. Historians, as historians, tend to be particularly eager to explore origins. And in the world history context, this can involve trying to push greater attention to the early development of human societies, to the early emergence of civilizations, sometimes at some expense to more recent developments. It's a valid option. It's not the one that we will be emphasizing in this course, although I want to pick up some elements of it, but it certainly needs to be noted. The second approach simply acknowledges, and this will become clearer when we move into these time periods, the second approach simply acknowledges that the greatest contributions of world history scholarship to our understanding of the past, the greatest changes in our perspectives on the past, have particularly applied to the post-classical period, roughly 500 to roughly 1450, and to the period right after, the early modern period. Here, as we will explore later on, is where really our understanding of the past has particularly been altered, including, by the way, our understanding of where Western developments fit into a broader framework. So there is a sort of second world history emphasis that will pay due attention to origins, but revel particularly in the time period roughly 500 to roughly 1750. Finally, however, and this is my own approach, I think ultimately it's particularly important to see both the early and the middle phases of world history contributing to an active modern period, and a modern period that then can be used, along with the earlier elements, to help understand the world in the present day. So, in this course, in my opinion, obviously with full validity, in this course, we will be emphasizing the connections between earlier phases of world history, more recent developments, and, ultimately, the world present, and maybe even to some extent, the most probable developments in the future. As we work on world history, a couple of other frameworks I think can help us make sure we keep an eye on the woods and just not the trees. The first framework is a familiar one. World historians, like any analytically sensitive historian, world historians are interested in the balance between, the tension between change and continuity. World history can sometimes seem to focus particularly on changes. Each of the major time periods will involve a new framework. But we also obviously want to pay attention to continuities, to ways that human societies persist or at least maintain a certain level of persistence. And one reason for the civilizational approach, the first of the three approaches I mentioned earlier, is indeed that it helps us keep tabs on some continuities, some traditions, juxtaposed with some of the new elements in the global framework. So balance between change and continuity, which is really the most standard analytical staple of the history craft, is certainly present in world history. The second tension applies more specifically to world history itself, from the earliest points to the most recent. There has always been a certain degree of tension between developments and identities formed in particular localities and regions and the advantages of contact and the exposure to more cross-cutting forces. These operate, obviously, in tension. We will argue later that probably the first large portion of the human experience, up until about 1,000 years ago, placed more emphasis on the local and the regional than on the contact and the combination. And then for the last 1,000 years, including obviously today, the balance has shifted. We place more emphasis on contact and cross-cutting, less emphasis on local and regional developments and identities. But the tension is always there. It's vivid in the world today. We can see it back in the classical period or even before. And this is a skein to maintain as we run through the course of world history. I mentioned earlier that world history certainly needs to pay some attention to civilizational traditions, and we'll be working on that reasonably systematically, particularly in the next set of lectures after, indeed, the very next one. But I think it would be useful to have in advance a certain sense of geographical coverage. As we will try to define more clearly later, civilizations are not magic or indisputable products. They involve retrospective definition, and definitional issues will sometimes be crucial. But most world historians use at least something of the following framework, although they may break it down in greater detail depending on how much time they have for their subject matter. We will be, over time, looking primarily at seven civilizational/geographic areas. East Asia, certainly. South and Southeast Asia, and sometimes we can deal with them as a whole. Sometimes we'll need to emphasize some subdivisions. Third, the Middle East, and ultimately the Middle East and North Africa, though that's not a combination that emerged right away. Fourth, Eastern Europe. Fifth, Western Europe. Sixth, Sub-Saharan Africa. And seventh, what ultimately became the newest of the major civilization areas, Latin America. This leaves a few parts of the world out, most obviously North America and Pacific Oceania, and we'll have to talk later about how we put these regions into a civilizational map. But this at least can help get us started. A final definitional point is really very specific, and I almost apologize for it, but I think it has to be mentioned. World historians in the United States use BCE and CE as their main chronological divides. They add up to the same things as BC and AD, but BCE stands for before the Common Era, CE for the Common Era. It's the same dating, but the argument is that since this is a world history dealing with a large number of religious traditions, to use specifically Christian designations just doesn't quite fit. Now, this terminological nicety, it's clearly an example of political correctness, may be a bit annoying. I know that some people think it's sort of silly. But I will be using it because it's a convention in world history and I don't want to get kicked out of the craft. And also because it does usefully remind us, and here's the one valid, clearly valid element of it, it does usefully remind us that as we turn to world history, we are really taking a step that differs from the Western-focused history that many of us were exposed to in our own educations. All of us, at least at my age and even a bit younger, all of us who do world history are converts. We were not trained in world history. We picked it up because we thought that this was an important new vantage point for the reasons I already indicated, important particularly because of its role in helping to prepare American students and a wider public for the global framework within which our society now operates on and on which our society has impact. If you don't know world history, I think it's fair to argue you may not be as well prepared to handle world issues at the present as you should be, just as in earlier decades in the 20th century, you could make the valid argument that if you didn't know Western history, you would not be as well prepared to deal with the issues the United States faced in relationships to Western Europe as you should be. Our world has shifted, and therefore the history we need has shifted as well. Let me end with a very specific point. I mentioned earlier that conventionally world historians end one period around 1450 CE and then pick up the early modern period. 1450 will, in some ways, seem pretty familiar to those of us trained in Western history. It has some relationship to the Renaissance, the Reformation is looming, and these things actually are relevant. But 1450 is a date in world history much more obviously, because it begins to introduce some key changes in the Middle East, North Africa, some key changes in Russia and Eastern Europe, some key changes looming soon in the relationship between the Americas and the rest of the world, and through this, many of the products and trade routes that would affect virtually every society in the world. And only as part of this wider scheme are the developments in Western Europe specifically to be fit. World history periodization will not always seem totally unfamiliar in the dates used, but it will, I hope, seem quite different from what we're used to in a Western framework when we get into the reasons for the choice and the basic factors to be explored. Welcome to the World History Train. Our next stop will be the rise of agriculture.